Thank you so much, Junwoo. It's really nice to be back here at PI. Thank you so much for inviting me. So what I'm going to talk about today is an ongoing project in collaboration with Justin Curie and Benoit Fahmé. And the main goal of this project is to try to understand whether the radial acceleration relation can tell us something about the nature between of interactions between baryons and dark matter. So to start, I'm just going to start with some motivation, and I'm going to review in particular what this radial acceleration relation is. Then I'm going to move on and describe the setup that we're going to use to attack this problem, namely the basic equation that we will try to solve, as well as the main assumptions that we're going to make about the nature of baryon dark matter interactions. Then next, we're going to apply this setup to galaxies, and in particular, spiral galaxies and ellipticals, and see what our assumptions about what kind of results we get out of the assumptions we made regarding the nature of baryon dark matter interactions. Of course, when you postulate some interactions between baryons and dark matter, you also need to worry about all possible constraints, from direct detection, going all the way to cosmology. And I'm going to briefly touch upon that in the fourth part of my talk. And finally, there is going to be just a little bit of field theory in the last part, where I'm going to try to at least discuss a few possible avenues of model building to implement the assumptions that we've made at this stage in a concrete particle physics model. And of course, if at any point you have questions, feel free to stop me. So let me start with some motivation. So most likely, all of you know that galaxy rotation curves are one of the oldest and main evidence for the existence of dark matter. So what I'm showing here are, in the upper panels, are three different rotation curves from three different kinds of spiral galaxies. And the lines that I would like you to focus on are the black dots, which are the experimental data, and the blue dot, which, sorry, in the blue line, which is it's a rotation curve that you would infer just based on the baryons that you can see. And as you can see, the fact that these two things are not, don't look the same is what we regard as evidence for dark matter, as you well know. Now, one thing I would like to point out is that depending on the kind of galaxy we're talking about, these rotation curves can have very different shapes, in particular depending on how much baryons there are. So you can see they can asymptote to a flat value from above, from below, or very, very slowly. But regardless of the particular shape, they are known to satisfy a universal relation, which is an empirical relation known as the baryonic Tully Fisher relation, that links the fourth power of the asymptotic value of the velocity to the total, baryonic mass in the galaxy. So this is the first fact that I would like to point out. And the second fact has to do with this bottom panel here. Now, as we move from the left to the right in the rotation curve, so we move outward in the galaxy, in these panels, where I'm plotting the gravitational acceleration due to baryons versus the observed gravitational acceleration that you would infer from rotation curves, in this panel, at the same time, we are moving from the right to the left. So we're going towards region of smaller acceleration. And as you can see, towards the outer part of the galaxy, where dark matter starts dominating, the observed and baryonic acceleration do no longer fall on a diagonal line. In fact, you start seeing more acceleration than what you would infer from the baryons. And as we move to galaxies that have more and more dark matter, we're moving more and more to the left in this plot. So dark matter-dominated galaxies tend to have smaller acceleration. And this is a point that is going to be important for what follows. Now, these are just three galaxies, but Stacy McGough and collaborators have repeated this exercise for 153 these galaxies, and they'll stack them all on this plot, showing again the gravitational acceleration due to baryons versus the gravitational acceleration inferred by the rotation curves. And what you find is that in regions of relatively large acceleration, which are the regions where the galaxies are dominated by baryons, the observed and baryonic acceleration match. Whereas if you start to going to smaller acceleration, you have a departure, which is similar to the ones you saw in the bottom panel before. What I would like to point out, the important point is not that we have a departure, which we would expect because we have dark matter, but is that in this region, where galaxies are predominantly dominated by dark matter, there is still a very good correlation between the acceleration due to baryons and the total one. Okay? So to rephrase that, as you can see, this curve has a very small spread in this region. And this is something that naively you wouldn't expect, because in galaxies that are dominated by dark matter, you should be able to change a little the baryonic content since it's subdominant, and that would amount to having different values for the baryonic acceleration for any given value of the observed acceleration. So the fact that we don't see the spread and that these two quantities seem to be very closely tied together is what is known as the radial acceleration relation. And in the low acceleration regime, the curve is very well fit by this MOND formula, which in fact was proposed precisely to fit this kind of data. And let me just to point out that if I replace the acceleration in this formula with v square over r, and I replace the baryonic acceleration with gmb over r squared, and I get rid of the r squared factors here, what I end up is a relation with between v to the fourth and the total mass of the baryons within a radius r, which now is not only valid asymptotically, like the baryonic Tolle Fischer relation, but it's valid also at intermediate radii. So this is a kind of a generalization of the baryonic Tolle Fischer relation. And this is what, in this talk, we would like to try to explain by introducing interactions between baryons and dark matter. Okay.
Bottom left.
This one?
Yeah.
That's a very good question. I have no idea.
But the galaxies are blue.
So the galaxies are all the blue dots. They are in a logarithmic scale, in fact. So the shades of blue are in a logarithmic scale. Okay. And what they're plotting are all the data points for all the rotation curves for all the galaxies. So like in this graph here, you had an overlap of data points of three galaxies. The same exercise was repeated now for 150-something galaxies.
And can I ask how they picked those 150?
So they are actually a very, heterogeneous sample in the sense that it includes these galaxies that have a large range in rotational velocities, luminosities, different amount of gas, different surface brightnesses. So they try to have a sample which is as representative as possible. And then the constraint was that they wanted to have good enough data about the luminosity of galaxies, but also have data about the rotation curves. And so, Okay, so this is what we would like to explain. And of course, we're not the first ones that would like to try to explain this. And perhaps the most conservative approach is to say, oh, well, it's just lambda CDM cosmology. You just need to introduce and take into account carefully just feedback in your simulations. And to the best of my knowledge, the problem with this approach is that it doesn't seem to give you a small spread in this region. So you get a relation that looks like this, but the spread at small accelerations, as you would expect, is actually much larger than what is observed. Another possible avenue is to just modify gravity, like for instance MOND or its relativistic generalization Tevez. Or a more recent example is this model of superfluid dark matter that Justin and Lascia Bereziani worked on, where in this case dark matter is supposed to be in a superfluid state, and phonons in the dark matter medium, since they are gapless excitations, mediate an additional long-range force between baryons. And if you choose the equation of state for the superfluid in the right way, this extra contribution to the force can actually allow you to recover this behavior. Now, the approach that we're going to take today instead is different. Rather than introducing new interaction between baryons, I'm going to consider interactions between baryons and dark matter. All right, so to do that, the most kosher thing to do would be to start with the Boltzmann equation for dark matter, where on the right-hand side you have some collision term that takes into account the fact that baryons and dark matter are interacting. And the gravitational acceleration here is determined through Poisson's equation. And on top of that, you should also have a Boltzmann equation for your baryons, which is going to look very similar, except that here you're going to have the distribution in phase space for baryons. And on the right-hand side, you're also going to have some collision term. Now, at least at this stage, at first pass, if we want to make some progress analytically, we're going to need to make some approximations. And the first approximation that we're going to do is focus on equilibrium configurations. And in particular, for the sake of this talk, just to simplify some of the future equations, I'm also going to assume approximate isotropy in velocity space, which means that the bulk velocity, meaning the average of the momentum k, mediated with this distribution function, is going to be approximately zero. And so what we're going to do, moreover, is don't worry about the Boltzmann distribution for baryons. Take the distribution of baryons as given, since that one we can actually, we know what it looks like by just looking at galaxies. So take that as a information that I have, and focus just on the Boltzmann equation for dark matter. Moreover, rather than solving the Boltzmann equation, we're going to consider the first few momenta of this distribution and try to solve the equation for the first few momenta and truncate the hierarchy. So, of course, the zero momentum of this distribution is just the number density of dark matter, which I will denote with n. And in the approximation where I'm considering static solutions, and the continuity equation then just becomes trivial. The first non-trivial equation, though, is the first moment where I basically multiply by k Boltzmann equation and then average over k. And that gives me an equation for hydrostatic equilibrium, where once again g, the gravitational acceleration, is determined by Poisson equation. And for this talk, rather than working in terms of temperature, I'm going to work in terms of velocity dispersion, v, which is related to the temperature, like so. And the last equation that we're going to consider is the heat equation that we get if we take Boltzmann equation, multiply by the energy, and then average over all momenta. And we end up with something like this that tells us that the divergence of the heat flux, in our case, since we have some interactions with baryons, is going to be equal to some heat source. Now, if we want to make more progress and try to solve these equations for rho and v, we need to make some assumption to turn this into a closed system of equations. And focusing on the heat equation, the first thing we're going to do is assume that the heat flux is proportional to the gradient of the temperature. And the proportionality constant is just the heat conductivity. Now, this is a very standard result. It's called Fourier's law. And in fact, it can be actually derived from Boltzmann equation in the hydrodynamic limit. But in general, you should think of this as just being the first term in a gradient expansion, which is valid whenever the temperature varies, doesn't vary much over landscales of order L, where L is the typical distance traveled by a particle in order to change appreciably its velocity. Okay, it's essentially like a mean free path. So under these assumptions, we can derive a microscopic expression for the heat conductivity, which looks like this, where C is the specific heat, which is just a number of order one, which won't matter for us. But most importantly, the expression contains the number density of dark matter, the typical length traveled by a dark matter particle, and the relaxation time, which is the typical time it takes for a dark matter particle to lose memory of its initial velocity. Okay, so with these two expressions, we can simplify the left-hand side of our heat equation and cast it in this form, where now this side essentially just depends on density and mv squared. And the L and the relaxation time will depend on the kind of system we consider, meaning spiral galaxies versus ellipticals. And I'm gonna say a bit more about that in a moment. Now, let's worry about the right-hand side. For the right-hand side, you're gonna need some particle physics inputs. And so the first assumption that I'm gonna make is that interactions between baryons and dark matter are elastic. And under this assumption, I can prove in to a fair degree of generality that this heat source is given by the number density of dark matter times the interaction rate times the typical energy exchange in a process, which I'm denoting with epsilon. And let me just remind you that the interaction rate in turn is given by the number density of targets, baryons in this case, times the transport cross section times typical speed v. Very good. Next, we're gonna need to make some assumption about the cross section, and this is gonna really be the main assumption that I will make about the nature of dark matter baryon interactions, and perhaps the main equation that I would like you to take away from this talk. What I'm gonna assume is that the product of the cross section times the typical energy exchange goes like a constant, where C will turn out to be just a number of order 1/10. Constant divided by the number density of dark matter, okay? So this product depends on the local density of dark matter. So in the next few parts of this talk, we're gonna see how much mileage we can get out of this assumption. And at the end, we're gonna come back to it and try to see how easy or difficult it is to get it from a reasonable particle physics model. Now, the last assumption that I'll make is that for the purpose of this talk, I restrict myself to situation where dark matter is much heavier than baryons, in which case the typical energy exchange is of order mass of the baryons times v squared, and in particular, it's positive. So this means, with my conventions, that on average, dark matter loses energy by interacting with baryons, and therefore that dark matter cools down. And so where in regions of the galaxy where we have more baryons, we're gonna expect to have a slightly colder dark matter than in the outer regions. And we'll come back later and check this prediction. All right, so that.
I think I missed something at the beginning with the definition. So you have some effective temperatures?
Yes.
The temperature, so is everything in is the temperature of the dark matter the same as the
baryon? No, very good. So that's
the temperature.
Very good. So that depends on the system in general.
Yes.
So for instance, for spiral galaxies, the velocity dispersion, which is like the temperature of dark matter, actually turns out to be much larger than that of baryons. Although it is of the same order as the bulk velocity.
So it's kind of impossible to see that. Do you use that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Sorry,
there's a blur. Oh, yeah. No, I mean, it wasn't a very profound equation. I was just saying that the velocity dispersion of dark matter is of the same order of the bulk velocity of baryons. But so the baryons in a spiral galaxy have a collective motion, but have very little velocity dispersion compared to the velocity dispersion of dark matter. Whereas in systems like ellipticals, for instance, the two temperatures, well, the two velocity dispersions will be comparable.
The temperature will always be much higher because the dark matter is heavy.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
The cross section that you're taking seems very large, I mean, but maybe, I mean.
It seems very large, yeah.
Yeah, so just to make sure I'm not mistaken, in terms of centimeter square, how much is it?
How much is the cross section?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you're making me jump the gun a little bit here. I was going.
Yeah, well, I will wait.
Okay, if you can resist, okay. I will address that though. It's an important point, absolutely. Okay, so this was a lot to take in. So just to summarize, after we've done all these simplifications and these assumptions, these are the equations that we're gonna look at. We're gonna use Poisson's equation to determine the gravitational acceleration in terms of rho and rho b, density of dark matter and baryons. And we'll combine it with the hydrostatic equilibrium equation and the heat equation to solve for V and for rho, okay? Like I said, we're looking for equilibrium solutions, and our assumption is that this equilibrium is reached because dark matter and baryon are interacting with each other. So it better be the case that these kind of interactions happen sufficiently frequently, okay? And we can check that because so the timescale tau for typical timescale for energy loss is associated to the interaction rate that I wrote before.
So yeah. What do you mean by equilibrium here? Because it can't be that your dark matter has gone into equilibrium with your baryons, because the dark matter would be moving much too slowly.
That's right.
So what do you mean by equilibrium?
So I just mean that we're going to be looking for stationary solutions to our heat equation and.
I just thought it wouldn't get stationary until the dark matter and baryon temperatures were the same. But then by that point, it's dead. Like some kind of quasi equilibrium, presumably, but what?
I think it's fine to have. How can I say that? Yeah, it's a quasi stationary solution, if you want.
Okay. What processes are and aren't in equilibrium? So there's still energy transfer from the dark matter to the baryons. So the dark matter is still cooling down, and the baryons are still getting heated up, but what things have reached quasi-equilibrium?
No, but so, well, maybe this will become a bit more clear as I go later on in the talk, but the point that I'm just trying to make is that we're clearly looking for solutions that are time independent, and so it better be the case that for this, in order to be able to reach these configurations that we're going to discuss, it better be the case that the time scale for energy loss be smaller than inversible.
But not, like again, you don't want to reach equilibrium too much because then your dark matter will cool down too much.
That's right. So I think, yeah, as you'll see, we're going to be.
Between two time scales.
Yes. Let me. Okay. Okay. Maybe we can discuss more of this later. Okay. But the point I wanted to make here is that since we know how to express the interaction rate using our master equation in terms of density, we can derive an expression for this timescale for energy loss, and in particular, the product between tau and H naught is just given by some factor of order 100 times the velocity dispersion times the ratio of the two densities. So this means that we can go and look at various systems and their typical values of rho over rho b and their typical velocity dispersions and figure out a priori whether or not we can expect what I'm going to say to apply to this kind of system. So on the one hand, for instance, the spectrum, we can look at elliptical galaxies, which are typically baryon-dominated objects. So this ratio is smaller than one, and velocity dispersions are of order 10 to the minus 3. So this bound is comfortably satisfied. On the other hand, for galaxy clusters, velocity dispersions are higher, and on average, these objects are dominated by dark matter in such a way that this product is actually larger than one. And so in this sense, what I'm going to say is not going to apply to galaxy clusters, which is good because we know that galaxy clusters, in fact, don't seem to follow a radial acceleration relation.
So V is particle velocity.
So V is the here is the velocity dispersion of dark matter. Yeah. Okay. So now let's see what we can say about galaxies, and let's start in particular with these galaxies. So from the viewpoint of a dark matter particle in the halo, there are essentially three timescales that are relevant. There is the timescale tau halo, which is a timescale for energy loss while the dark matter particle travels in the halo. There is a dynamical time R over V, which is basically the time it takes for a dark matter particle to sample an appreciable portion of the galaxy in the absence of interaction. And then there is tau disk, which is the timescale for energy loss inside the disk. And the assumption that I'll make, which I can justify and check a posteriori, is that these three timescales follow this hierarchy. So what this means is that in words, essentially, in first approximation, dark matter particles travel almost unimpeded through the halo and take a certain amount of time to find the disk. But when they do, interactions with baryons in the disk are fairly efficient. So under these assumptions, the relaxation time is dictated just by geometry, by how long it takes for a dark matter particle to find the disk. Okay? And similarly, also the length scale L is dictated by geometry. It's just by the radius of the orbit times some geometric factors, pi's and stuff like that. So when I plug this in the expression for the heat conductivity that I had before, what I find is that kappa scales like nRV. Okay? And this is a fairly well-known result for a very dilute gas, a gas in this in this configuration is known as a gas in the Knudsen regime. So this is a regime where, for instance, if you have a gas with which is so diluted that the mean free path is much larger than the size of the box, this gas is going to reach thermal equilibrium not because the particles are interacting with each other, but because they're interacting with the wall. And in this scenario, this is the relevant expression for the heat conductivity. And so the analog here, you should think of the disk in the galaxy as being like the wall in the box, and the halo as being the inside of the box.
Just to, you said they're reaching equilibrium because of collisions with the wall, but collisions with the wall are elastic. So that can't thermalize a gas. So what?
Yeah, I'm not sure I see your point, because even so, if I have a box,
so
if I
have energy distribution of molecules in the gas,
yeah,
which is non-thermal, mm-hmm, and we want to thermalize it.
Yeah. So
if something hits a wall,
yeah,
doesn't change its energy. We're having a wall that's the wall is also a bath with some temperature.
Yeah. Okay, so just to make some more progress, we're going to do an extra approximation here, which is we're going to take this nice disk and redistribute the baryon content in a spherically symmetric form, and so just work under the assumption of spherical symmetry. So to do things carefully, what we should do is just solve numerically our equations, but just to gain a little insight, what we can do is do some back of the envelope calculations at first in the regions of the galaxies that are dominated by dark matter and those that are dominated by baryons. So let's start with dark matter dominated regions. What we can do is start with the hydrostatic equation, where now, because we are in the dark matter dominated region, the acceleration here is mostly due to dark matter. So this is the total mass of dark matter. And if I assume some power law behavior for rho and v, I can integrate these ones to get to find an expression for the dark matter density. Similarly, I can take the heat equation and, assuming a similar power law behavior, integrate it once. Now, on the right-hand side, I have rho b times rho squared. When I integrate it, I get the total baryonic mass within a certain radius r. And I can now replace rho using this equation and integrate once more to get up to a log a behavior of the form v to the fourth goes like baryonic mass times some constant. And now, at very large distances from the center of the galaxy, where the velocity, where the total baryonic mass becomes approximately constant, so does the velocity dispersion, which means that we can use results from an approximately isothermal distribution. And in that case, we can replace, we can trade the velocity dispersion of dark matter for the rotational velocity of an object inside this dark matter halo, and find a relation that looks like the baryonic Tully Fisher relation, or like the Mond law. So this is a back of the envelope argument for why we expect our kind of interaction to give rise to the correct phenomenology. Now, we can play the same game also in baryon-dominated region, and I'm going to spare you the details. The only difference is that from the get-go, the dominant gravitational acceleration is due to baryons rather than to dark matter. And assuming, again, power law behavior, you turn the same crank, and the result that you end up with tells you that the product of r times rho of r, dark matter density, is approximately constant. And this is a result that seems to be well supported by data. This product is known as the dark matter surface density. All right, so this was just, like I said, a little back of the envelope estimate. To do things precisely, we can solve our equations numerically and for rho and for v. And if we do that, this is what we find. So the red curve is, so first of all, we solve this equation under the assumptions that the solutions are regular at the origin. And after doing that, we are left with two free parameters that we fix by demanding that our solution, shown here in black, becomes constant where we know that galaxy rotation curves become constant, so not well after. And the second constant is fixed by demanding that we match the correct asymptotic velocity. Okay, and if we do that, then you see there is an extremely good match with the red dash curve, which would be the prediction of Mond, which we know to be a good fit for a kind of galaxy like this. And for this L here is the typical length scale associated with the distribution of baryons, which I'm assuming to be an exponential that decays like e to the minus r over L. So this is the parameter L here. Tells me how spread out or peaked is the baryon distribution. Now, for comparison, this is the rotation curve that I would infer only because of baryons. And the purple line, finally, is the velocity dispersion of dark matter, which, as you can see, it's approximately constant. So we have an approximately isothermal distribution, but still it decreases towards the inner part of the galaxy where we expect to have more baryons. And it is in this sense that, so this agrees with what I said before, meaning that we expect interactions between dark matter and baryons to cool down dark matter.
A lot of dark matter, it's very heavy, so is it still consistent with the disk?
Yeah, so this is So it's a good question. It's something that we haven't done yet. So like I said at the beginning, for now we are forgetting about the Boltzmann equation for the baryons. But to do things in a kosher way, you should actually solve numerically the couple of differential equations. So yeah, this is something that we actually want to address at some point in the near future. Okay, so let me now move on to a different type of galaxies, namely elliptical galaxies. And the reason why these are interesting from our viewpoint is because, so they're not rotationally supported, they're pressure supported. And this means, for practical purposes, that baryons are no longer just segregated in a disk, but they are actually mixed with the dark matter fluid. Nevertheless, like I said before, they are in equilibrium based on this criterion. And so we think we can apply this formalism. However, what we need to do is adjust the heat conductivity to keep into account that now the typical length scale travel is not going to be dictated by geometry anymore. Okay, it's going to be dictated by essentially the mean free path and the mean free time. And when we do that, we end up with a heat conductivity that now depends not only, it depends on a different power of the density of dark matter, but also on the density of baryons and on the velocity dispersion of dark matter.
Do you form a dark disk at that stage?
Sorry, say that again.
Are you going to form a dark disk at that stage?
If you're going to form a disk in this case?
We have a lot of dissipation in the dark matter sector, so
yeah.
The yellow is going to be flattened, but going to
yeah, no, yeah, it's a good question. So I think both the previous question and also this one touch upon the issue of, okay, you have equilibrium configurations, but in a sense, can you reach them? Mm-hmm. And so this is something that at this stage we haven't addressed yet. We should address with the... What the only thing we have checked, I should say, is that again, focusing just on the heat equation and hydrostatic equilibrium equation for dark matter, we've checked that these equilibrium solution that we found are actually stable. So if we perturb them a little bit, they just perturbations don't blow up. Yeah.
Sorry, can we go back to Robert's question from before, or should we wait a bit longer? Because I'm still so. The time scale that you're calculating here is the time scale to lose an order one fraction of the kinetic energy, but that's
yeah.
Still much, I mean, you need a huge amount of these to cool the dark matter down to the same temperature as the baryons because you're assuming it's very heavy. So it's not really in equilibrium, it's just enough time for the dark matter to lose a bit of its energy.
I think it all depends on the
cross section. Yes, of course,
but
that's
what
that means. So, because you're assuming to derive your equations, you're assuming that it's in equilibrium, but it looks like you haven't actually reached equilibrium because your time scale is just kind of one e folding or whatever half life or something. So I'm not sure if it's consistent.
So I think it goes back to the same, like Robert is saying, the same issue of what it means equilibrium, which I think I'm not doing a good job at addressing right now. So if you don't mind, let me postpone that to later, and maybe we can talk about it more offline. Let's see, how am I doing with time? Okay. So now for elliptical galaxies, I can use the same, this expression for heat conductivity and run the same kind of power law arguments that I did for spiral galaxies. And if I do so, what I'm able to find is that the gravitational, in these kind of systems, the gravitational acceleration due to dark matter is, in first approximation, a constant, approximately equal to a naught. Okay? And this is interesting because this is something that wasn't on our radar when we started this project. What we were really trying to explain was the behavior of spiral galaxies. But in the meantime, this paper came out by people at Penn. And what they did here is study the subdominant contribution to the gravitational acceleration, meaning the one due to dark matter, for elliptical galaxies. So in this plot, what they're showing, the blue data are in a region of small acceleration, and they belong to spiral galaxies, whereas the interesting part for us are the red data, which are about elliptical galaxies, and almost 7,000 of them, to be precise. And so what this plot does is compare on a logarithmic scale the acceleration due to baryons with the ratio between the acceleration due to dark matter and the ratio due to baryons, and the acceleration due to baryons, okay? So let me zoom in just on this portion, which is the portion that has to do with ellipticals. And what this author finds is that the best fit to this data is given by this dashed black line, and is such that this ratio, A dark matter over A baryon, goes essentially like A baryon over A naught to the minus one. So if I flip the power, I can simplify the acceleration due to baryon and find that the acceleration due to dark matter is approximately equal to A naught and approximately constant. Okay? So at this stage, we only have a back of the envelope kind of argument, which seems very encouraging. And one thing that we want to do in the near future is also try to put this on more firmer ground by doing some numerical simulation. All right, now let me just finally go back to your initial question about cross-sections. Let's talk a bit about constraints. So the cross-section that we have depends on the density. And in fact, for elastic interactions, it depends also on velocities. So one thing we can do is use the local values for the dark matter density and for the velocity dispersion to estimate the ratio between interaction cross-section and the mass of dark matter. And what we find is something of this order, which is rather large. And remember, we are in the regime where dark matter mass is much larger than the baryonic mass. Now, let me come back to this point in a moment. Let's do it now. What I can also do is use the master equation and combine it with the requirement that we are in a Knudsen regime, which means that I want the mean free path in the halo to be larger than the orbital radius r. Now, the mean free path due in particular to self-interaction is 1 over sigma n. So if I combine it with our master equation, I can put a bound on the ratio between the cross-section for self-interactions and the cross-section for baryon-dark matter interactions. And using the fact that we know that the radial acceleration relation is valid up to accelerations that are two orders of magnitude less than a naught, we find that sigma needs to be somewhat smaller than sigma int, but not way, way smaller to be compatible with the Knudsen regime. Okay, now let's go back to the interaction cross-section. Now, like I said, the value we find is sigma over m of order 1 or 10 centimeter per gram squared. So this puts us basically on a line right here. And as you can see, at first sight, it looks like this region is completely blocked by many constraints. But if we look at them a bit more closely, so the dark gray constraint comes from simulations of galaxies and galaxy clusters. You don't seem happy.
I was about saying, forget those ones. It's a dark matter, basically dark detection, which is dark.
Yeah. Sorry, say it again.
You have a cross-section which is basically 10 to minus, 5, 10 to minus 24 centimeters
yeah.
For a particle of 1 GeV. Mm-hmm. So between 1 and 10 GeV, you may escape a little bit, but after 10 GeV, you have all the direct detection constraints, which are straight away.
Yeah, but those go up to certain values of the mass.
GeV to whatever, 100 TeV, that would
have... That's right, but here the kind of... mass that I'm advocating is actually much heavier. So on this plot, just to give you a, so the Planck mass is over here. So
you're making a macro.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm considering a macro dark matter, in which case all those direct detection things don't apply. And so the most relevant, otherwise I agree with you, we would totally be in trouble. So that's why I was discussing these bounds, and I was making the point that the dark gray contour follows from simulations where you have self-interacting dark matter, which in our case is actually not an ingredient at all. We, in fact, can make self-interaction as small as we want. And so this, I don't think that applies. The bound on large-scale structures instead, in principle, does apply. But I will show you in a moment that because our interactions are suppressed by the density, as we go back in time and densities become much larger, our interactions become much weaker in such a way that, in fact, this whole bound gets lifted. And it's not a problem anymore. So the main constraint comes from this Skylab constraint. And in order to be clear of that, we want to be about here in order to clear it comfortably, which, as I said, it gives us masses of the order of the Planck mass. Now, about the large structure. So the fact that we're considering elastic scattering means that our master equation implies that interaction cross-section should go like 1 over v squared. And for cross-sections that scale like powers of the velocity, Cora Dvorkin and collaborators were able to put a bound from large scale structure from the fact that in this redshift range, the main idea is that dark matter perturbations start growing in that period. And if the coupling between dark matter, whereas at the same time, baryon perturbations do not, because this is before recombination. And so if there was a significant enough coupling between baryons and dark matter, this could prevent dark matter from start growing perturbations and could mess up the large scale structure that, that we observe. So with this kind of argument, they were able to put a bound on the product of v squared sigma int over m of this form. Now, this bound was derived for cross sections that are velocity dependent, but otherwise constant, independent on density. Now, one would probably need to redo the analysis more carefully in our case, but the zeroth order check is just to apply it to our case, keeping in mind now that our sigma int, like I said, goes like 1 over the density, and using the cosmological density. So this product in our case looks like that, and for z's of order 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5, this becomes of order 10 to the minus 12, 10 to the minus 15, so clearly much smaller than this bound. Now, let me just say...
I missed if you... So this is an assumption that you put in that it goes as 1 over the density?
No, well, so this is the... If you remember, this this master equation that I wrote at first was that... Because of that, the product of the cross section times the typical energy exchange should go like a constant, factor of order 10, times mass of baryons over a naught over n. So when the interactions are elastic, the energy exchange is approximately mb v squared. You can simplify this too, and I end up with a.
Yeah, I just mean there's not kind of a model that this comes out of. This is something that. This relation is what you need to get the first equation to work.
That's right. So everything I've said so far came just from that assumption. Now, in the next 10 minutes, maybe 7, I will try to give you at least a toy model to show you that it's not too crazy to get a cross-section that scales like that, OK? So in fact, let me just go very briefly over the bullet cluster, just to say that the same reason why galaxy clusters are not in equilibrium, that time scale is also the same time scale that would determine the energy exchange between clusters, which is what is constrained by the bullet cluster. And so the same reason why I'm claiming that these are not in equilibrium also ensures that we are compatible with this constraint. Now, let me conclude talking a little bit about model building. And like I said, like Masha pointed out, this is essentially what I've been using all along throughout this talk. So it would be nice to see that this can come out naturally in particle physics, at least in the regime that I've been discussing. And of course, we know very well how to get velocity-dependent cross-sections. For instance, through phenomena such as Sommerfeld enhancement, we can get inverse powers of velocity. Or if we have interactions in a plasma, where the interaction are not between charges, but between a charge object and, an object that had just a magnetic dipole, you can get a cross-section that goes exactly like 1 over v squared. At the same time, we also know of ways of getting cross-sections that go like inverse power of the density. One example, for instance, could be phonons. So if baryons were to interact not directly with individual particles, but with collective excitations in the dark matter fluid, then we know that interactions among phonons or between phonons and other objects in the medium are naturally suppressed by the density of the dark matter medium. There is only one problem with that scenario, which is that phonons are collective excitations, and as such, we can trust them only over scales that are much larger than the mean free path of the elementary constituents. And the fact that we want to be in a Knudsen regime tells us that the mean free path must be larger than the scales we're interested in, and so there is no regime in between where we can trust an effective theory for phonons. But there are, however, other ideas that one can play with, such as, for instance, having a mediator that acquires a mass proportional to equal to a plasma frequency, and the plasma frequency is proportional to the density. So one can play these kind of games. The challenge, of course, is to get both the correct velocity dependence and the correct density dependence. So let me just show you a quick toy model that does this. And I'm calling this a toy model because there is, not even by a stretch of the imagination, this is an extension of the standard model. This is just some non-relativistic field theory where psi is my dark matter, non-relativistic dark matter field. And I can get away with writing down a non-relativistic field theory because, as I showed before, the typical velocity at play are always much smaller than the speed of light. So this is a little ugly to look at. Let me just point out that, yeah, so the psi is the dark matter field, and phi is the field that is going to mediate interactions between dark matter and baryons. And I'm going to write down interaction with baryons in a moment. So this looks ugly, but in fact, it's actually, this structure is nailed by symmetries, in particular by Galilean symmetry, and by Schrödinger invariance, which is a non-relativistic limit of conformal invariance. So from this viewpoint, you can think of this phi as being some essentially non-relativistic dilaton. So it's fairly easy to check that, in fact, this Lagrangian is invariant under this scale transformation. The reason why we also have these two terms at the bottom is because we also want to realize the Galilean special conformal transformation, okay? And let me point out that this is symmetry is exact as zero chemical potential, but as we go away from zero chemical potential, this term is actually not invariant. But that is okay because at finite density, the scale invariance is spontaneously broken because this operator, which is the density, acquires a non-zero VEV. And so when we implement finite density at the level of the Lagrangian, this is equivalent to an explicit breaking in the Lagrangian of the symmetry. Okay, so the main mechanism at play in this model is the following. Notice that the first, this line here is just equal to the pressure of the dark matter, of the dark matter sector. So I can look for, I can calculate the effective potential for phi at, in the presence of a non-trivial density of dark matter. And if I do that, what I find is that I get a non-trivial contribution from in this interaction, which is proportional to the pressure of dark matter, which is just mmv squared. And so if I look for a static solution to the equation of motion, I find that the VEV phi star satisfies this equation. So e to the 3 q phi star goes like this 1 over square root of mmv squared. And notice that I wrote things this way because this is precisely the factor that appears in front of the kinetic term for phi. Okay? So at finite densities, this gives me some wave function renormalization for phi. And by the way, something that I should have also mentioned is that I haven't written any kinetic term for phi here, meaning with time derivatives, because that is forbidden by Schrödinger invariance. So at the level, if we're working with a non-relativistic field theory, then it's not a problem. We don't necessarily need to have a kinetic term for all our fields. So expanding our field around this VEV, we end up with some cubic interactions with between dark matter. Now this is the canonically normalized dark matter field and this perturbation sigma. And we can add some symmetry breaking coupling with baryons. And even though this coupling is not invariant under our Schrödinger symmetry, it's perfectly fine because regardless, we'll want this charge Q to be very, very small because, of course, phi is now also going to mediate direct interactions between baryons, and those are very well constrained. So we know from the get-go that this coupling must be very small, and so even if it breaks our symmetry, it's going to do so in a way so that our symmetry is still a good approximate symmetry. So if we go and look at the amplitude for now baryon and dark matter scattering at three level, the propagator is going to contain this wave function renormalization factor, which scales like 1 over square root of mv squared. And so in the regime where the momentum transfer is much larger than this, this mass, these two factors cancel out, and I end up with a constant amplitude proportional to 1 over mv squared, which gives me a constant cross-section proportional to 1 over mv squared, exactly like what I have up there. So this, of course, is just a toy model at this stage to try to show that it's not too crazy to get a behavior like that. But of course, there are many ways in which this should be improved, and there are many things that we want to do next with this kind of approach. Like I said, we got most of this mileage just by assuming that cross-section times typical energy exchange goes like 1 over n. But at the level of model building, the first thing one might want to do is try to come up with a model which is actually relativistic. That would be nice. And another idea that would be nice to explore is this idea of having baryons interact with collective excitations. Like we said before, phonons don't work. But there are other collective excitations that are actually that propagate in the opposite regime as phonons, meaning they propagate at scales much smaller than the mean free path. And this is, for instance, zero sound in Fermi gases. So something that would be nice to explore is whether one can use zero sound and interaction between baryon and zero sound to get a behavior of that form. Now, at the level of phenomenology, something that I haven't mentioned at all is the opposite hierarchy, namely the hierarchy where dark matter is much larger, sorry, is much lighter than baryons. And that's something that we also want to explore in the near future. And finally, there is this issue of trying to get away from just studying equilibrium solutions and studying how whether this equilibrium solution that we found can actually be reached dynamically. But for now, let me just stop here and thank you for the attention.
Questions for comment? Or light would light be then?
So I think it would be definitely sub EV. It would require significant more work just to understand exactly how to redo this analysis, because I've made certain approximations when I approximated the heat source, epsilon dot, and that were valid in particular for heavy dark matter. And so this all right hand side of the heat equation would need to be reworked now in the opposite case. So it's not, I don't think I have a good answer for that at this stage.
So what is the requirement on the 5S? Is there like, you need it to be very light?
So in that particular model that I've shown, yeah, so we just need it to be lighter than the typical momentum exchange, which would be of order MV. So
Yes.